The headlines: Iran's president says United States and Israel are the biggest violators of human rights despite all efforts to portray themselves otherwise. Hundreds of rights organizations are demanding international action against Israel's administrative detention of Palestinians. And more bad news for the UK economy, raising fears of a deeper recession. Will be live in London with the latest. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's president Ebrahim Raisi says U.S., Israel, and some Western countries have a dark history of crimes committed against humanity.
The biggest human rights violators are the U.S., Israel, and some Western countries, despite their claims to be human rights defenders. See their record, what they have done to their own people and the people around the globe.
Addressing the 36th International Conference on Islamic Unity, Raisi said steadfastness and resistance are the solutions to Muslims' problems, including the Palestine issue. He said the U.S. and the Israeli regime are trying to marginalize Palestinians through normalization deals. He noted that Palestinians have themselves realized that resistance is the only solution to liberate their occupied lands. The conference has brought together 200 Muslim clerics and intellectuals from some 60 countries. The annual event puts into discussion the challenges faced by the Muslim world. Journalist Sayed Zafar Mehdi earlier told us that some Arab states have betrayed the Palestinian cause for cheap political and economic gains by signing normalization deals with the Israeli regime.
At a time when the project of new imperialism and takfirism and Zionism are being aggressively promoted and marketed to divide Muslims, to create problems for Muslim nations, it's become all the more critical and important to uphold the banner of unity, brotherhood, and tolerance, you know, not just in theory, but also practical, you know, talking about the issue of Palestine. The issue of Palestine, without any shade of doubt, is the litmus test of Muslim unity today. It has been repeatedly emphasized by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It's the issue of Islam, it's the issue of humanity, you know, the liberation of occupied Palestinian territories from the illegitimate West-backed regime should be the top priority for Muslim world. And President Raisi also pointed it out very clearly today, you know. And it's preposterous, you know, it's very preposterous that some so-called Muslim states, Arab states, have betrayed the cause of Palestine for cheap political and economic gains by playing into the hands of Americans and signing so-called normalization deals with the occupying Zionist regime.
Nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. In a joint statement, they called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. The groups say that Israel is currently holding around 4,700 Palestinian prisoners, including women, children, and people suffering from various illnesses. The statement said that detainees are being subjected to arbitrary arrest and torture, which are both violations of international law. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians, urging the international community to pressure the regime to end the practice. The much-criticized policy allows Israel to indefinitely imprison Palestinians without charge or trial. Palestinians stage a general strike in occupied Al-Quds in solidarity with the people of the Shawafat refugee camp and its nearby town of Annaha. Israel has placed a complete lockdown on the camp and the town after a Palestinian operation left a regime soldier dead and another wounded. Earlier, our Ramallah correspondent joined us with details on the situation there.
We are speaking about almost 150,000 Palestinians or less living in Shafat refugee camp, and Annaha town in Al-Quds had been facing siege-like conditions, we can say. Israeli forces sealed all the entrances to Shafat refugee camp and to Annaha town. They are searching for a Palestinian. They accuse Uday al-Tamimi, 22 years old Palestinian from Shafat refugee camp. They accuse him that he was the Palestinian man who opened fire at Israeli military checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat, killing an Israeli female soldier and wounding others. The Israeli military claims that Uday al-Tamimi is still inside the Shafat refugee camp, and that's why a closure is imposed, or a siege is imposed on the Shafat and Anata. As you have mentioned, Palestinians in Al-Quds, in the other towns of the occupied city of Al-Quds, declared a commercial and educational strike where all shops were closed. Schools have also closed as well. Tires were burnt in the main streets of Al-Quds.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah says the resistance movement will stand by the government in its decision on the maritime deal with Israel.
We will remain vigilant until the government officially announces the deal has been signed. I know all the Lebanese people want this issue to end, but we need to keep vigilant since the other side might change their mind any moment.
Nasrallah once again warned the Israeli regime against looting Lebanon's natural resources. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun had earlier said he would hold consultations with political groups for a unified position before giving a go-ahead to the deal. The potential agreement with Israel seeks to settle Beirut's maritime dispute with the regime over a gas field in the Mediterranean. Earlier, the presidential office said the draft meets Lebanon's demands and protects its rights to natural wealth. It said the agreement will pave the way for Lebanon to explore offshore natural gas reserves. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, recounts why the deal is significant for Lebanon, adding it's the first time Israel has succumbed to the demands of an Arab state.
We have three main issues here. Number one is that we have a deal. It's been very discreet, of course, but we know some details. We know that Lebanon will be given definitely 923, and Lebanon will also be given a potentially rich field called the Kana field, which goes beyond line 23. It's not just line 23, so we have something line 23 plus. In addition to that, we have assigned a confirmation from the United States that Lebanon may begin immediately to drill in its waters, and no one will come near that right, and no one will stop that right. So these are three very significant issues that we do know from sources, of course. This has been translated by a meeting today between Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the Energy Minister Fayyad, who met with representatives of the French petroleum company Total, and they have asked the company to begin directly to drill in Lebanese waters. So this is very significant for Lebanon. It is the first time, and as we hear from Israeli media, that this is the first time that the Israelis actually succumb to certain demands from a single Arab state and accept its demands for Line 23, which was something that we saw 11 years ago as almost impossible.
A prominent Muslim cleric and the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria has accused the government of hiding the truth about the 2015 massacre of his supporters in the northern city of Zaria. In an interview with the Arabic language Al Alam TV network, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki said over 1,000 IMN members were killed in the Nigerian army attack some 7 years ago. The cleric said the figure includes a number of those who remain unaccounted for and were most likely killed. That's why official figures put the death toll at over 380. The Nigerian cleric noted that the Zaria massacre was not an isolated case of brutality against Muslims. He said various Nigerian governments have tried to either weaken or eliminate the Islamic movement since it was born in the late 1970s. Sheikh Zakzaki underlined that the movement has only grown stronger despite all those nefarious efforts. The latest official data shows the British economy shrank further in August, strengthening predictions that the country will fall into a recession. According to the Office for National Statistics, there was a surprise 0.3% drop in GDP. Both production and services fell back as challenges to the economy took their toll on the output. It means the economy is on track to contract overall in the third quarter. The Bank of England had previously warned about a recession. By the end of the year, Britain is already struggling with a cost-of-living crisis amid decades-high inflation. The market is also in turmoil over a debt-fueled budget, which includes an energy price freeze. That's part of the government plan to protect families and businesses from soaring energy bills. Prime Minister Liz Truss has promised her economic measures will speed up growth, but the Premier is facing criticism even from party colleagues over her plan. We're now joined by our correspondent, Saeed Puruzo, who's with us from the British capital, London. Saeed, it's great to have you with us. Let's talk about the tumultuous economic times that Britons are facing right now. Is Britain inching closer to that recession by the end of the year that the Bank of England had predicted? And also, what's on the plate for the new Prime Minister in terms of economic growth?
These are tumultuous times, Barry, as you rightly said. And yes, all indicators are that the UK economy is headed for recession later on this year, as predicted by the Bank of England. And the Prime Minister definitely has a lot on her plate, a little over a few weeks into her premiership. Already, we have seen the announcement of that so-called mini budget that sent the markets into a tailspin. Kwasi Kwarteng, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is off to the United States to attend the annual IMF meeting, the International Monetary Fund, which has, over the past 24 hours, said that the measures that the UK government has taken will lead to growth. But it's also said, and that's not what you hear from the government, is that the UK economy, the inflation in the UK economy, is going to persist more than any other advanced economies. What's happened is that the cuts that they announced, I should also remind our viewers that the U-turn that they had forced to do on the 40p tax cut for the highest earners in the country. The other measures are still in place and they are still defending them. They're still plumping for those measures to go ahead, tax cut for big corporations, as well as a decrease in income tax. They're saying that somehow it's going to work, somehow everybody's going to benefit from these cuts. But the opposition has been up in arms. They are very critical, saying that this is trickle-down economics, that it's not going to work, that the government will have to change their mind while they have the time. The problem is, Badia, that by that reversal on the 40p tax, they have saved some $2 billion, pounds rather, it's nearly $3 billion, but then they need another $40 to $65 billion to be able to fund the tax cuts that they have given these big corporations and others. And that is where the problem is. And all of this at a time when inflation is at nearly 10%, interest rates have gone up, and the public faith in the government has really been shaken. And we saw warning shots coming from members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party in the question time yesterday, where the Shadow Chancellor, as well as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, locked horns discussing the way forward. So that is a problem. Now, what might happen now is we don't know yet where the Chancellor will be cutting or saving money to be able to cost or to fund the tax cuts he has introduced. The NHS has the largest budget, but will they touch that? Probably unrealistic given what happened during the pandemic. It's underfunded. They're probably not going to do that. Then there is defense. Liz Truss, the Prime Minister, announced the biggest defense budget, 3% of the GDP, even more than her predecessor, Boris Johnson, had announced 2.5%, or her prime ministerial rival, Rishi Sunak, the former chancellor, who said he would have increased the defense budget by 2.7%. Probably not that too. So what remains will be education and welfare and others. Now, welfare, you're looking at more than 20 million Britons receiving some sort of welfare or government financial help. And a lot of people People who receive, for example, universal credit are already struggling because the 20-pound increase to their welfare help from the government during the pandemic was cut. That was introduced by the former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. A further cut to the money they're receiving from the government will really make it very difficult for these people who are looking, of course, all of that during a time when inflation, as I said earlier, is at nearly 10%. Oil prices are going up, plus the coal season, where energy prices are still going further up, Bardia. Very tough times ahead for the public and for the UK economy in the coming months.
All right, thanks a lot. Syed Putas are joining us from the British capital, London. Elsewhere, Russia's Federal Security Service, FSB, says it has arrested 8 people in connection with an explosion that damaged the Crimea Bridge last Saturday. The detainees are set to include 5 Russians and 3 Ukrainian Armenian citizens. The FBS says the explosives were stored in plastic film rolls that left Ukraine in August and transited through Bulgaria, Georgia, and Armenia before entering Russia. The agency says the explosion plot was hatched by the main intelligence directorate of the Ukrainian Defense Ministry. Ukraine has not officially confirmed its involvement in the blast, but some Ukrainian officials have celebrated the damage caused to the bridge. Russia has conducted massive missile strikes on several Ukrainian cities and infrastructure this week. President Vladimir Putin says the strikes were in retaliation for what he called Ukraine's terrorist act on the Crimea Bridge. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Imam Mahdi, Axis of Unity. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the Unity Week. The Unity Week is the period between the 12th and 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. As it has been said earlier, this week spans the 2 days believed by Sunni and Shia Muslims as the birthday anniversary of the Prophet of Islam. This initiative was proposed by Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, to bring Muslims of different sects closer to each other and make them a single monolithic ummah against the sworn enemies. Today we are going to discuss the role of Imam Mahdi as the axis of unity among Muslims. Stay tuned, please. More than 14 centuries have passed since the emergence of Islam, and there have been differences among Islamic denominations. History bears witness that whenever Muslims have practiced according to the teachings of the Noble Quran, they have achieved progress and power, while disputes and clashes have weakened them and paved the way for dominance of enemies. That's why God says in Ayah 46 of Surah Anfal of the Noble Quran, "And obey Allah and His Apostle and do not dispute, or you will lose heart and power will be gone. And be patient. Indeed, Allah is with the patient." Today, practicing this divine command seems quintessential, as the domineering system is hell-bent on fomenting discord among Muslims by every hook and every crook. However, Muslims enjoy many commonalities which can make them unified and monolithic. These main commonalities include the belief in one God, His Prophet, the Noble Quran, and also the belief in the awaited Savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. The Noble Quran clearly speaks of the universality of Islam and the rule of the righteous on planet Earth. Moreover, many narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his infallible Ahlul Bayt, blessings of God upon them, explicitly point to the lofty personality of Imam Mahdi and his global rule. In a famous hadith, the Prophet says on Imam Mahdi, "A man from my Ahlul Bayt stages an uprising whose name is my name and his nickname is my nickname. His temperament is like my temperament, and he fills the earth with fairness and justice as it has been filled with oppression and injustice." Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the leader of the Hanbali sect of Sunni Muslims, narrates a hadith from the Prophet. "If there remains only one day from the world life, God will make that day so long that a man from my progeny will rise up and fill the world with fairness and justice as it has been filled with oppression and injustice." According to the Quranic teachings and the words of the Prophet, all Muslims can share the belief in the coming of the last savior of mankind. Shia Muslims believe that Imam Mahdi has been born and lives in occultation by God's will, while most Sunni scholars maintain that he has not been born yet. What advantages can be achieved through unity around the axis of Imam Mahdi? Firstly, he is the symbol of hope in a bright future. Thus, the believers in his reappearance are not disappointed with the oppression of tyrants and the lackeys. They recall Ayah 105 of Surah Anbiya, where God says, "Uncertainly we wrote in the Psalms, after the Torah, indeed my righteous servants will inherit the earth." Accordingly, Imam Mahdi will be the leader of the righteous. The righteous are awaiting for him, and this waiting is very important, as is considered as a great worship. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "The greatest act of my ummah is waiting for the reappearance of Mahdi." For sure, this waiting should be constructive and real, rather than stupefying. In other words, the awaiting person should comply himself with the values and goals of the awaited Savior. This will act as an engine and will motivate the believer to do his best in removing the barriers of the coming of Imam Mahdi. The believers in Imam Mahdi never accept oppression and tyranny. Imam Mahdi is the reviver of the religion of his ancestor. So, how can one claim to be waiting for him while sitting idly with no reaction against injustice and corruption in the world. Muslims who are waiting for Imam Mahdi try to coordinate their life with the Islamic lifestyle. They do not pay attention to the destructive Western way of living where no human and divine value has remained. As it was said, Imam Mahdi will establish a global government on the basis of the Islamic teachings. Materialization of this goal is joyous for every Muslim and believer. This can be a strong factor for unity of Muslims. As a matter of fact, this unity and convergence on lofty values and ideas will set the ground for the reappearance of the awaited Redeemer of mankind. If Muslims gather around this lofty belief, God will surely expedite his reappearance.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to sanctions, Iran has been a target of Western countries for quite some time, especially the U.S. And now with the most recent protests, which consists of foreign-backed riots, sanctions are raining down on Iran, from Canada's sanctions on Iran's press TV to the IRGC members, to the U.S. and U.K. sanctioning of Iran's police. We ask, does the U.K., or Western countries have the ground to stand on when it comes to human rights or the right to impose sanctions when they are guilty of human rights violations in their own country? And don't their sanctions constitute interference in other countries' affairs? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. He joins us. He's a political analyst from London. Also joining us is Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'd like to first start with you, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, if I may, and ask you about the UK sanctions, where they have sanctioned Iran's police. And at this point, the quick question that comes about is, does the UK really have a leg to stand on when it comes to the issue of human rights, of which it is basing its sanctions on?
Well, certainly not at a time where Julian Assange is rotting in prison, facing
what no one really understands what charges, since the charges from the Swedish lady who initially pressed charges against him have been dropped. And obviously he's being maintained in solitary confinement, which is actually a violation of basic human rights. So just on that element alone, I think Britain doesn't have a leg to stand on. But of course, there are so many other details. For instance, war crimes committed by British soldiers, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, in the way they were treating civilians. So of course, Britain has no leg to stand on. But we're used to seeing Western nations actually lecturing other countries on human rights and on issues such as these, whilst at home, or for their own, actually never respecting those very basic human rights that they feel others should abide by.
Shobha Brisby, taking a look at the EU, they have issued a resolution against Iran, and I need to just get justifications from you, and that's why I'm reading off some of the countries or organizations that have leveled sanctions, and in this case, resolution, where it said the resolution criticizes the necessary countermeasures that Iran has taken against the organized acts of violence. Why does the EU feel that it has to come into the picture as a whole and issue a resolution against Iran?
Hello, good evening, Kavan. Obviously, we saw recently one of the Swedish MEP in Brussels cutting her hair. So tonight, I'll be cutting the tie to show that this is the symbol of oppression, which everyone should take off their ties if they want to be part of the resistance movement. Now, coming back to your question, why EU at this time? As our fellow colleague from London quite rightly pointed out, that not only there's hypocrisy and double standards on part of the Britain, but the whole of the European Union, from tiny countries like Lithuania, Estonia, and others in the Baltic and other countries in Europe, they quite often work in cahoots with Washington to put pressure on Iran. As you can remember, even Iran is the country for the last 42 years, the West has been at war with Iran in one form or another, whether it was the eight-year war inflicted on Iran via Saddam in Iraq, or sanctions being applied, or nuclear scientists being assassinated. All kinds of conspiracies and intrigue has been created for the last 42 years. If there were any other nation other than Iran, it would have succumbed by now. The only reason why all these measures are being applied to Iran is that because it does not support the Zionist entity in West Asia. Tomorrow, if the government and the leadership in Iran decides to recognize Israel, then hunky-dory, there is no human rights issue. There are no problems with Iran. Iran would be in the good books of the West. Uh-huh. So the reality is that it's the support for the Palestinians and being part of the resistance and really not recognizing the Zionist state that has created the problem for Iran for the last 42 years. Not pitifully of the death of this particular young lady. That just a decoy to hoodwink the world into thinking that West is on the side of the human rights.
Sympathize strongly with the passing away of the woman is what Iran's president has said. Iran's leader has said that also, that it was a sad thing, Hafsatkar Mustafa. But this is the statement that we continue to hear. We will continue to work with our partners to hold Iranian officials accountable for gross human rights violations. Keep hearing that over and over again, and mostly this comes from the U.S. Is this a line by the U.S. to tell its partners that you should go with the line that we're telling you or asking you so we can all appear as a united front against Iran? Is that what it's trying to do here?
Well, I think at this particular moment in time, I think what the EU and America are trying to do is push Iran in a corner because it's a major gas producer, and they want to make sure that Iran will succumb and will adhere to whatever conditions that are imposed by West by Western powers when it comes to trading with Iran. So push it in a corner in order for Iran to then be far more compliant. I'd have to say it's not just about Israel, because the Shah was actually recognized Israel, and at the last minute he was dropped by the West. So Israel is inevitably an element of why the West is constantly against Iran, but it's also a way of maintaining it is a resistance country that hasn't complied in any way to any Western pressure, but it's also the way of keeping pressure because it's a major oil and gas producer, and therefore it's a way of making sure that when you play hot and cold with a country like Iran, you can manage to force it to comply, which it doesn't. Can I just add also that just before the COVID pandemic started, for instance, France had faced major human rights violation issues when it shot and when it maimed scores and hundreds of protesters during the Yellow Vest movement that lasted almost a year, and no sanctions were ever imposed on it, despite major evidence that the police were literally shooting to maim the protesters. So we can see constantly the double standards when it comes to countries such as Iran. And of course, it is basically designed to weaken these countries and to force them to accept whatever terms and conditions is imposed on them in order to allow them to trade more easily.
Iran has come out and said that the internal issue of the Islamic Republic is related to the governments and the nation of Iran. Shabir Rizvi, we will not allow any country to interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Where do you think that line was crossed when it came to the reaction by, let's say, the UK or the US or the EU or Germany for that matter?
Well, as I said, the line was crossed when the advent of the Islamic Revolution occurred back 42 years ago. Since then, there have been all kinds of maneuvers that have been used by the West to continuously try to weaken Iran. But the reality is that no matter what methods they use, no matter what sort of technology, I mean, recently, the cyber attacks that have been taking place in Iran is another aspect, plus the use of the social media that is occurring to ignite certain elements of the public to come out on the streets. And the reality is that, like the sister said, that, you know, what happened in France with the Yellow Vest. But the reality is that if you look at the USA, I think the latest figure before coming on to this interview I was looking at, during this year, 1,117 people have been killed in police custody in the USA. So really, you know, how does America and the West have any leg to stand on when they talk about brutality by the Iranian government, when they are not only brutal and commit atrocities on other countries, but they also do the same to their own people if they're standing against, you know. And the thing is, the demonstrations that take place in the West are not really to change the government, not to change the political system. People are usually asking for their basic rights. For instance, over the weekend in UK, there were demonstrations up and down the country in support of cost of living, the price of energy. And again, over the weekend, there were demonstrations in Germany, in Holland, in Italy, all over the place, with the cost of living crisis that is facing the West. So when there are demonstrations just for basic needs, those demonstrators are in a way beaten up, and all kinds of issues are used. I just want to remind your audience and sort of recap back here in 10 years ago, there were demonstrations in London virtually over the weekend in many, many cities. What happened at that time, hundreds and thousands of people were arrested and got a criminal record. The courts sort of sat overnight to send people into prison. It was a riotous situation. And again, people were demanding basic rights, not demanding the change of government. If, for example, if the demonstrators did come out in Paris, London, or New York demanding the change of government, then I can see very easily when people were killed at Kent University 60 years ago demonstrating against Vietnam War. So there's a whole litany of human rights abuses by the West in their own countries against their own people for decades.
Okay, Shabir Rizvi, House of Karim Mustafa, mentions how the media encourages, Shabir Rizvi, correct me if I'm wrong, for people to come out and protest. So usually when they do that, in many instances, if not almost all instances, they are putting that in the context of a video where people are actually vandalizing or setting something on fire. So that's, in a sense, encouraging to incite violence. Now, at the same time, we are looking at the double standards at play here, which I'm trying to understand how they think they can get away with it when you have, for example, what happened in the protests in London a few weeks back at the Iranian embassy, where protesters, many of them were Iranians, actually clashed with the police in London. Then the Met said, we got to go after them. These people, because some got away, I guess. The Iranians, that is. And there was some pictures that were plastered, kind of like a manhunt. I'm not too sure if they got them yet or not. That approach is okay for London, but not in Iran. In Iran, come out, protest, violence, etc. What do you think about the way that the UK is displaying itself there?
Well, again, I mean, it's been very hypocritical, but it always is. Just to pick up on the other panelists' point, again, there were in 2010, in the harsh winter, which is one of the coldest winters on record, students came out to protest against tuition fees, and the police introduced a method called kettling, which meant that they were kept standing still for 6-7 hours in -4 degrees temperatures, and they couldn't move. And those who tried to move were arrested and were given exemplary sentences up to 4 years for simply attempting to leave the ring and to leave this sort of kettling method. So the brutality, police brutality, whenever anyone takes to the street to protest, even for basic things such as banning tuition fees, is actually repressed in the most violent ways. And yet here you have people actually encouraging Iranians to go out and to break and to commit violent crimes, which is, again, I mean, the hypocrisy is staggering, but we're so used to it. I think people have just become accustomed to it and no longer know what to say. But I think public opinion is not as on board as it used to be. I'd love to say that overall people are seeing through the propaganda, Western propaganda. They're not. But many do realize that there is a double standard. Many have also pointed out the fact that in France, women, for instance, are not allowed to wear the hijab, and no one said anything about the basic human rights of these women. When you see French women sort of cutting their hair as a symbol to support the Iranian women, knowing, can I add, that the current Home Secretary, the Interior Minister of France, has been accused by 4 different women of rape. So when a French woman goes to the police station to complain that she's been a victim of a sexual assault, the boss of the police officers has actually himself been accused of rape by 4 different women. So this is the absolute comical scenario, had it not had such dangerous consequences, that we're currently living. We're living in times of absurdity, and no one can see through it.
Well, the thing that is very alarming here is the way that the approach is being used by certain governments, which is now somewhat coming to light, that there may be political, perhaps, intentions. This is another side to this whole saga, if you may call it, Shabir Rizvi, where you've had certain politicians come out and say, I believe it was the UK Foreign Secretary that came out and said this, that Iran should behave, Iran should not deal with the protests violently, because if it wants, for example, for there to be, and Iran should not go after the nuclear bomb, all within one context, alluding to the fact that Iran should stop this, and along with that, it might find a way for this JCPOA revival sanctions removal talks to happen, if you know what I'm getting at with this. So are we looking at governments trying to somewhat push Iran using the protest as a means to get back or to come into the deal that has been worked on for quite some time?
Well, look, if you want me to address the issue of JCPOA, I think that's not really quite fundamental. Whether the JCPOA comes to an agreement or not, that's not an issue. But I think whether it's the UK Foreign Secretary, Mr. Cleverly, or any other Western leader, whenever they get on their pulpit and start preaching to a nation like Iran on human rights abuse, on XYZ, I think they should really look closer home and really try to sort of implement policies which would be in favor of the ordinary people here. You know, our previous Home Secretary, Priti Patel, passed legislation where even demonstrating would become illegal in the UK. And the current Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, is even sort of extraordinary trying to implement policies of all kinds, whereby they want to send, people coming to UK as asylum seekers to Rwanda. So all kinds of different human rights abuses are taking place in the United Kingdom and most of the European countries. So really, at the end of the day, I think all the nations, all the sort of Western nations, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, European Union, and USA really should analyze what they are doing themselves. But I dare say, because the reality is that they feel that they are right, they have the arrogance to continue on the same policy, and really they suffer from hubris, to use a phrase which is often used to describe this kind of a situation, when the people who continually speak a lie start believing that lie and think that they are taking the right path. But the reality is that, as our other guest speaker was saying, that I think at least some people, even in the West, are realizing the hypocrisy of their own governments. And I think the cost of living crisis and what's happening with Ukraine will perhaps remove the veils from the eyes of the people, right, who still feel that the West is always right.
I'm going to reflect on a statement made by a former CIA official, Hafsa Mustafa, if I may, to get your reaction on this, because this relates to what Iran's leader has said, where Bruce Riddell, who was a former CIA official, said there's little doubt that there is a covert war that's underway against Iran, and there are at least two players in it. It's the U.S. and the Israel. How much do you think that this statement made by the Bruce Riddell actually applies maybe to what is going on here? Because we know, obviously, in terms of Israel and also in terms of the U.S., this has been going on for quite some time against Iran.
I mean, surprisingly honest coming from a CIA source. But again, I mean, if it's a CIA, he obviously knows what he's talking about. And it's true. Since the Iranian Revolution back in 1979, Iran has been in the firing line of both America and Israel. And it's the only country that has been consistently opposed to any normalization with Israel, has closed the former Israeli embassy, replaced it with a Palestinian embassy. So it's constantly inflicting humiliation upon humiliation on Israel, and Israel is not accepting this lightly. So, you know, the more Iran resists, the more Israel will apply pressure. And unfortunately, of course, as with many other countries, you have, what Malcolm X refers to as the house slaves, the people who actually are inside and who serve foreign interests. And I think that could be a danger for Iran. But of course, I think that when push comes to shove, Iranians have always showed to rally amongst each other and in support of their government, and always rally against foreign enemies because they know that they're a target. And therefore, even though I think things look worrying at this very moment, if anything, I suspect that when the worst comes to pass, actually Iran will come out of this stronger. And it will come out of this stronger. Why? Because, of course, Europe is about to face a wave of civil unrest over the cost of living crisis. And I think, ironically, it will be the opportunity for many Iranian Twitters and people on social media to then encourage their Western counterparts to do what they're currently doing to Iranian protesters.
Well, here's a good point. And this is really sad but the differentiation needs to be mentioned again, Shabir Rizvi, and that is the fact that if you had, which I'm sure there were people who were protesting when this protest first broke out, that even though it was not related in their eyes when they came out to protest to the unfortunate death of that young woman, but they were protesting because they were perhaps economically were not privileged. You know, they had financial, perhaps, gripes that were plaguing their daily lives. But this protest got stolen once violence kicked in and once there was rioting and once there were destruction of property, of which that particular sect of the protesters, that's not what they obviously wanted to promote, to have their voices heard. How do you think, I mean, this is speculation maybe, but how do you think that happened where that division all of a sudden appeared and then the ones that were protesting peacefully went out of the picture and now it's just people who want to vandalize in a sense? Not all of them still, but a majority of them.
Well, look, at the end of the day, in every country there are economic issues, and particularly with Iran, when it has been sanctioned for the last 42 years, there will, of course, be issues which would affect a significant number of people. But there are ways of protesting, and also, as President Rouhani has quite rightly pointed out, that demonstrations are permitted in Iran, but violence of this type, killing of the policemen, destruction of property, burning of police cars, in any country, this will not be acceptable. So why should it be acceptable in Iran? But also you must remember, Kaveh, is that quite often there is a particular segment in each city, whether it's in London, New York, or Washington, or Tehran. There's a richer part of a city and perhaps not that well off. Of course, the richer part of any city are not the barometer of any nation. For example, in London, if you came and asked someone living in Hampstead or Kensington about cost of living crisis, they will have no idea. Similarly, in Iran, if someone living in sort of expensive parts of Tehran will not understand that.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Do appreciate that, though, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst. Hafsakar Mustafa, pleasure, journalist and political commentator, both from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikael Tahveh and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
from our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakati.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. This great Imam was one of the founders of the jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. He was one of the founders of the very jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt that represented creation, originality, and the progress of intellect. Scholars have reported from Imam al-Jawad a wonderful variety of wisdom and literature regarding noble deeds and conducts that are among the most precious maxims dealing with different educational and moral and ethical issues.
Parts of Ziyara texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed